Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. This is the Bible Gumshoe Podcast. Does God really bless the man who swears to do evil? Well, might seem like a strange question, but that is in fact what Psalm 15 says. Psalm 15 talks about the character of the righteous man who can dwell with Yahweh on his holy hill. This is a description of the man who is able to be in the presence of God. These attributes include doing what's right, speaking truth in one's heart, not slandering, or doing evil to one's neighbor. However, among the different descriptions of the righteous man in Psalm 15, one stands out as somewhat out of place. That is, that the righteous man swears to do evil and does not change. If you'd like to know more, keep listening to today's episode. Welcome to the Bible Gumshoe Podcast. In today's episode, we're asking the question, does God really bless the man who swears to do evil? Well, that is what Psalm 15:4 says. So, grab a cup of coffee, kick back, and let's dig in. In Psalm 15:4, nearly all English translations say that the righteous man, quote, swears to his own hurt and does not change, end quote. What could that mean? Well, until one checks the original Hebrew, you might understand the text to be saying something along the lines of what the NET, the Net Bible Translation, says, that, quote, he makes firm commitments and does not renege on his promises, end quote. Or, like the Good News Translation says, quote, they always do what they promise, no matter how much it may cost, end quote. Well, that seems plain enough, doesn't it? So what could the problem be? Well, the problem is that in Psalm 15:4, the Hebrew text actually reads, he swears to do evil and does not change. The typical English translation, except, I might add, for Young's literal translation, reflects either an interpretation of the original Hebrew or a variant reading found in the Septuagint. So let's dig into that variant reading for a moment. Now, the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Scriptures, which was made in Alexandria, Egypt, about 300 to 350 years before Christ, that translation says, he is one who makes a vow to his friend or companion and does not break faith. The Septuagint reading is speculative and would require a textual variant in which, now this is going to get a little technical, but hang on for a minute, in which a letter at the beginning of the word evil got moved to the end of the word, and that the first letter of the next word got duplicated and added on to the end of the previous word. All right. For the Hebrew geeks out there, the more technical way of saying this is that the variant reading is a vorlage which can be explained by the transposition or metathesis of the definite article he on the word hara, the evil, to the end of the word, making the new word re'ah, friend or companion, and then ditography, or the duplication, of the vav on the following word velo and not, which is then gets added on to the end of re'ah to form the word to his friend. So, if you followed all that, it's a whole lot easier to see than it is to hear. I hope I explained it well. But that's what would have to have taken place in the history of textual transmission and copying in order to get from the Masoretic text reading, he swears to do evil, to the Septuagint's reading, he swears to his friend or companion. Now, there are three reasons to suspect that the variant reading to his friend that's found in the Septuagint is not original, and that we ought to accept the reading of the Masoretic text to do evil as the original words of the psalmist, even though those are hard words and perhaps a little difficult to explain, though I think we're going to try. But first, I want to give my three reasons why the variant reading found in the Septuagint is probably not original. First, while the variant reading to his friend isn't impossible, it's made less likely by the need for the two different unrelated scribal errors that we mentioned earlier, metathesis and dactography. And they had to come together all at the same time. Neither of these errors by themselves is out of the question, although the first, metathesis or transposition, requires that the second letter in the word be accidentally moved to the end of the word. Now, could this have come about by some error of the mind in a scribe? Did a scribe simply misremember and write to do evil instead of an original to his friend? That's hard to imagine, given the shocking nature of the language. Did the scribe mishear or misread? Again, anyway, any of this is possible, but it's unlikely. Maybe one scribe might do this. But that doesn't explain how to do evil would replace to his friend in the wider manuscript tradition if to his friend were original. And of course, we still need that second scribal error, that dactography, or the duplication of the first letter in the following word. All of this is hard to imagine, even if technically possible. The most likely explanation is that the Septuagint is a guess based on what a translator or a scribe, if the translator was using an original manuscript, but it's probably a guess based on what he thought was the right reading. Or, like we said, if the Septuagint is based on a real manuscript variant, then we likely have a parallel tradition that would have probably arisen in an attempt to smooth out the hard saying of the psalm that God blesses the man who swears to do evil and does not change. So that's the first reason. The second reason is this. So we ought to ask ourselves which reading is easier to explain in the light of all the other readings. Now, this is a major tenet in textual criticism. We need to ask ourselves which reading best explains the rise of all the others. While the reading of the Hebrew is difficult for the pious reader's sensibilities, at least, the variant reading is much harder to explain as original. After all, and we've already alluded to this, if it were original, it's really hard to imagine how a scribe would change to his friend to a much more shocking and much more difficult to do evil. So to do evil, or rather, the variant to his friend does not explain the rise of to do evil, but the original reading to do evil would very easily explain the rise of to his friend. They're very similar. They look a lot alike. Like you said, the letters don't need a lot of juggling, especially if a scribe thought perhaps an error had been committed, or what we have is an accommodation. So in either case, to do evil best explains the rise of variant and not the reverse. Now, the last reason for accepting to do evil as original is this, and it's a non-technical reason. The psalmist says that the righteous man makes a vow. Now, the ancient Hebrew might make a promise to his friend, but when he made a vow, he only made it to God, never to other human beings. Since a vow was made only to God, it's hard to imagine how the psalmist could speak of a righteous man making a vow to his friend. So this really leaves us with only one realistic possibility. That is, that the psalmist really did say that the righteous man swears to do evil and does not change. But that still doesn't help us with what this could possibly mean. Is the psalmist saying that if a righteous man makes a vow to do something that is morally evil, that the righteous thing to do would be to fulfill that vow? No, that is not what the psalmist is saying, But in order to understand what the psalmist does mean, we need to go back to the law of Moses. That is, in fact, where the whole psalm ultimately originates. And we need to go back first to Leviticus 5:4, which gives us a clue. So Leviticus says that God will hold a person accountable. Quote, "If anyone utters with his lips a rash oath to do evil or to do good, any sort of rash oath that people swear, and it is hidden from him, when he comes to know it, and he realizes his guilt in any of these," unquote. The idea isn't that a person knowingly makes a vow to do a morally evil thing, but that after making a vow, he comes to realize that his vow was evil or bad, or in other words, possibly what's in view here is the idea that this person's vow will later bring economic hardship or ruin upon himself or his family. So Leviticus isn't speaking about making a vow to do moral evil, like murder, theft, adultery, or blasphemy. The vow may not be morally evil, but may involve something that ends up being harmful, or more than what a person can actually perform. Now, Numbers 32 says that if a man vows a vow to the Lord, or swears an oath to bind himself by a pledge, he shall not break his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. And Deuteronomy 23:21 says, "If you make a vow to the Lord, your God, you shall not delay in fulfilling it, for the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin." Deuteronomy 23:23 makes it clear that these vows are voluntary, and that a man should be careful what he utters with his lips, because God will require it of him. Leviticus 5:4 and other texts concerning vows in the law are the likeliest context for understanding Psalm 15:4. These texts make it clear that God will hold each one accountable for the vows he makes. However, a provision is made in the law to redeem a rash vow. Leviticus 27, 1-34 lays out a sort of conversion formula by which a man who makes a rash vow might pay a substitute in place of fulfilling his vow. Clearly, God makes provision for his people so that even in vowing rashly, their vows aren't binding in such a way as to ruin them or obligate them to actually perform an evil deed or to do something beyond what they're actually able to do. So while God holds people accountable for every word that they speak, for their vows made to him, God makes accommodation, this is called grace, for the things that we speak rashly and allows an alternate or substitutionary form of payment. In this we see God dealing in a gospel way with people, even with respect to their vows. So now back to Psalm 15:4. What does this mean? Well, Psalm 15:4 is dealing with a man's integrity. His word, the righteous man's word, is so good that he pays his vows to God, whatever the cost to him personally, even if such a vow should be evil. That is, even if his vow should result in his own personal impoverishment or harm. In this light, translations that interpret the Hebrew text as meaning he takes an oath to his own injury and does not retract it, as the Lexham English Bible does, are good translations of the text's meaning. However, remember what we noted earlier. An oath is always to God and not to one's neighbor. So, translations which render the wording as keeps his word or keeps his promises, as in to a neighbor, follow the Septuagint and don't bring out the full force of what the psalmist is actually saying. The Bible does teach that we ought to keep our word to one another, but that isn't what Psalm 15:4 is saying. Psalm 15:4 has to do with a man's integrity before God in that he performs all that he promises to God, even at great personal cost. This is what it means that a righteous man swears to do evil and does not change. You've been listening to the Bible Gumshoe Podcast, episode number 13. I hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you learned something. Until next time, don't stop asking the Bible those hard questions, but rather, study to show yourself approved, a workman who does not need to be ashamed of his coming. Bye now.